Today's episode is sponsored by Tego. For most of us, indemnity insurance is one of our biggest costs of practice. But when was the last time you took a look at the coverage and compared your premium with others?
Many of us are still with the same insurer we joined in med school or intern year. Thousands of doctors have made the switch to Tego and benefited from their personalised approach to pricing. You will also get an extra 2 months free in your first year.
If you are new to private practice, you might even qualify for 4 years of discounted premiums.
Tego offers competitive premiums, quality cover, and 24/7 support backed by top medico-legal advisors.
Get a free quote and discover why thousands of doctors are insured by Tego by visiting tego.com.au.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Deep Breaths, a podcast covering topics related to the Part 2 anaesthetic exam. I'm Dr. Kate McCrossan.
And I'm Dr. Kate Steele, and today's episode is Let It Be, where we'll discuss the recently published ANZCA professional document, PG67, guideline for the care of patients at the end of life who are considered for surgery or interventional procedures 2022. In this podcast, we represent our own views and not those of our employers or ANZCA.
Recently, ANZCA published professional document PG67, the guideline for the care of patients at the end of life who are considered for surgery or interventional procedures 2022, or more easily and conveniently known as end-of-life care. Its self-described purpose is to assist clinicians involved in caring for patients at the end of their life and in whom a surgical or interventional procedure is being considered.
Now, we wanted to have a discussion about this document because it does offer assistance in navigating the incredibly complex and grey area style decision-making process surrounding the appropriateness of proceeding with surgical interventions in this group of patients. Now, I'm sure many people listening today have had experience with this and know firsthand how challenging it can be.
Look, absolutely. Let's start our discussion by defining what the phrase end of life actually means.
End of life describes the period when death is anticipated due to disease progression, frailty, and general deterioration in physical and/or cognitive function. This period may be years before eventual death, or it may be a shorter period of time, like weeks to months.
End of life can be further divided into the palliative phase, which is defined as the time when the disease or condition is considered to be incurable and progressive, and the terminal phase, where imminent death is expected within hours or days.
To start, this document addresses the changing landscape that is both the case mix that we're seeing, where patients are increasingly elderly, frail, and with more complex and serious medical comorbidities, and the way that we approach these patients as anaesthetists. When we were training, it wasn't unusual to have to inform a patient that providing safe anaesthesia wasn't possible, but now it's almost unheard of.
So the reality we're faced with is that we can give seriously ill patients anaesthesia and patients at the end of their life, but of course they're very high risk by the nature of what they're experiencing. Just because we can do something doesn't necessarily mean that we should either, but these very complex conversations, they involve surgeons, interventionalists and ourselves, and it can be something that people can find uncomfortable.
Absolutely. So it's important to understand that the expectations of us as anaesthetists has definitely changed over the last 10 to 20 years.
We're now faced with the conundrum of being able to provide anaesthesia for more complex cases and having to sometimes stumble our way through conversations about appropriateness of care and end-of-life decisions and managing lots of different teams involved in those decisions and expectations from the various stakeholders. As well as that, we must manage our own emotions, beliefs and particular frustrations if we don't agree with a course of action.
Yeah, and look, the ethical and emotional ramifications of a death on the table in high-risk cases is also something we have to deal with and frankly get better at dealing with.
And not just for ourselves, for all the other people involved in the operating theatre or the interventional suite at the time.
Absolutely, because it affects everyone. And I mean, let's face it, a poor outcome can have an enormous impact on our own mental health, as well as that of everyone else we've mentioned, the nurses, the techs, the surgeons, everyone around us. And look, my last on-table death, thankfully, was several years ago now. And I remember distinctly for the month afterwards, I had horrific insomnia and nightmares, which had a massive impact on my mood and the way I interacted with other staff and also my family. And look, sometimes I think we all underestimate how being involved with end-of-life care and high-risk anaesthesia, particularly when there's a poor outcome, can actually affect us.
Yeah, it's very true. So PG67 defines several principles of care when being involved in the care of a patient at the end of their life and being considered for an intervention requiring the provision of anaesthesia. These are to identify patients at the end of life or diagnosing dying, inverted commas, to consider the intention of the proposed surgery or procedure, to promote a shared care decision-making process exploring patient-centred outcomes, to promote cultural safety, to mitigate the potential for clinical momentum if surgery proceeds, and to manage limitations on medical treatment, or LOMT, in the perioperative period, including medico-legal implications. To quote PG67, surgery should not be considered for patients at the end of life who have entered the terminal phase, but may be beneficial for those in the palliative phase, where anticipated survival can be months or even years.
In upholding these principles of care, PG67 lists a series of ethical and legal concepts that are important to keep in mind. Now, many of these will be familiar to you already, but it's worth revising them for clarity. So the first is that it is important to sensitively, directly, and clearly raise death and dying, risk and prognostic issues with patients, families, and substitute decision makers. Communication skills, training, and experience here are key.
Two, patients with decision-making capacity have the right to refuse any medical treatment, including resuscitative measures or surgery.
3. Doctors have a duty of care to patients that complies with legal, professional, and organisational regulations.
4. Clinicians are not compelled to treat dying people as if they are curable, nor to institute management that they consider too risky or unlikely to confer benefit for the patient, or in other words, futile treatment.
5. Advanced care directives must always be taken into consideration, and instructions, where legally binding, must be followed.
6. Patients or substitute decision makers should be consulted if limitations on medical treatment, LOMT, are implemented. This includes if modifications or suspensions are made to LOMT for the perioperative period.
7. In an emergency, consent does not need to be obtained for treatment that will save a person's life or prevent significant harm or distress to the patient, which is known as therapeutic privilege. This applies when patients lack decision-making capacity and their substitute decision-maker is unavailable in a reasonable time frame to provide consent. Advanced care directives, where known, can be used to guide treatment.
And 8. Medico-legal obligations vary by country, state, or territory. Doctors must be aware of the relevant legal and institutional requirements and procedures for the jurisdiction and the organisation in which they work. And we're in Queensland, and there actually are some interesting bits in Queensland that people, we won't go into that today, but it's worth looking into, and the intensivists will
The point is, be familiar with those things that are relevant to where you practice.
Correct.
So now on to the recommendations. So ultimately, PG67 defines two aspects of care with these complex end-of-life cases: evaluating benefits of surgery with respect to the patient's illness trajectory, values and preferred outcomes, and mitigating non-beneficial treatment and interventions if surgery proceeds.
Evaluating the benefits of surgery involves several important considerations and steps. The first is re-evaluating the requirement for the surgical intervention and the anaesthetic in the context of the patient's end of life. What phase are they in, palliative or terminal, and what is their anticipated disease trajectory? Do they potentially have only days to live, or is it more like months or even years? And what is the intention of the procedure? Some common reasons include diagnosis and developing a more clear prognosis, prolongation of life, symptom control or prevention, or indeed a combination of these.
The next step is to determine the patient's decision-making capacity. To refresh, and this quote comes directly from PG67's background paper, a person has decision-making capacity when they can understand, retain, and weigh up information and then communicate their decision. An adult deemed legally competent can consent to or refuse treatment offered to them as part of their healthcare. Of particular importance to remember is that consent can only be given for medical treatment that is offered after medical assessment and advice, and there is no right to either compel a clinician to treat a dying person as if they are curable or to institute treatment they believe to be non-beneficial or overly risky.
So for patients that do not have the capacity to consent, decisions are then guided by advanced health directives, advanced care plans, or the substitute decision makers. However, in an emergency, therapeutic privilege exists where medical treatment necessary to save a person's life or to prevent distress or harm to that person can proceed if the patient lacks decision-making capacity and their substitute decision-maker is not available within a reasonable time frame to provide consent.
The next step in evaluating the benefits of the proposed intervention is to promote and be involved in decision-making discussions, ideally with all teams involved in the patient's care. This discussion should involve several key components. What are the possible patient-centered outcomes or the patient's values? Some of these include survival, patient satisfaction, the impact on their functional status, their well-being, comfort, health-related quality of life improvement, and the preparation for a good death.
The recommendation for practitioners involved in these end-of-life shared care discussions is to work collaboratively and as a team. The patient or decision makers should be provided with a unified consensus and then be helped to work through the decision-making process, including the provision of evidence-based information and the discussion of periprocedural risk.
During these discussions, clinicians should also address any advanced health directives or care plans and their implications for the considered procedure and anaesthesia. Discussions should include hypothetical best-case scenarios and worst-case outcomes, specifically emphasizing the outcomes relevant to the patient's values and desires, rather than just the procedural risk. And talking about how the suggested intervention and its recovery fits in with the patient's aims and desires is also important.
The last step in evaluating the benefits of the proposed intervention is to be culturally sensitive and to promote cultural safety. In this step, it is important to receive assistance from liaison healthcare professionals to assist with guiding us where uncertainty exists.
In understanding the importance of upholding cultural sensitivity and safety, we must first understand an individual's cultural needs. And in our rich melting pot of cultures, languages, religions, and beliefs, it is highly likely that the needs of our patient does not necessarily align with our own cultural needs or benefits. For those of us practicing in Australia or New Zealand, the needs of our First Nations populations align with those of non-Indigenous people in their desire for holistic and patient-centred care with respectful communication. But there are differences too.
Some key preferences identified by Indigenous populations as being of significance and importance include family and community involvement, dying at home, ensuring their own wishes are known, reconnection with land, the provision of cultural and spiritual ceremonies within health service settings, and the availability of Indigenous staff. For Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander patients, it is important to be mindful of other important aspects of communication, which may include unspoken communication, the use of spokespersons within families and societies, and terminology used about death and dying.
For Maori populations within New Zealand, a model that represents a holistic and four-pillared approach to Maori health and total well-being exists called Te Whare Tapawha. Those four pillars are Te Taha Tinana, or physical health, Te Taha Whānau, or extended family, Te Taha Hinengaro, or mental health, and Te Taha Wairua, or spiritual health. The understanding of this healthcare model and its importance and relevance to Maori people can assist in providing guidelines for discussions about patient-centered outcomes, desires, and the implications of an intervention and anaesthetic. Now, I'm curious, Kate, do you have a specific approach that you find useful when trying to elicit what is important to a patient whose cultural or religious beliefs are either different to your own or where they're completely unfamiliar to you?
I don't think I'm the expert in this, and also I think cultural and religious beliefs can obviously underpin a lot of people's, you know, way they live their life. But I think every patient has their own, you know, has their own values and desires, and so I suppose it's just an extension of how I would try to treat every patient as an individual.
Yeah.
When it comes to cultural and religious beliefs, I think it's just being politely curious, you know. I'm struggling to find the best way to put it, but being respectful, being curious, and just feeling out the conversation, I guess. You know, one thing leads to another, and feeling out whether someone wants to discuss it, how much they want to discuss it, how much they want it to impact their care.
So it's
an interesting question to think about on the spot, but that's a rough way I would approach it.
I suppose I have, like, thinking about what I do, I probably have, if I feel like I'm asking anything that could be misconstrued for the purposes for which I'm asking it, often I explain why I'm asking. So if I'm asking anyone about illicit drug use, I say to them, look, I'm not judging.
Yes.
It's so that I know what you take, so that I can tailor my anaesthetic, so I don't give you anything that's going to make you sick. And I suppose, looking back at what I do, I think I probably do the same thing and sort of say, look, what's actually important to you? You know, this is all about you, and I don't want to do something that you don't want. Mm. So it's actually really important to know what your religious beliefs are and things like that, so that I can make sure that you get everything that is important to you and that means more to you and isn't sort of swayed by any of the other staff or anything like that. And I think just putting it in context sometimes makes people, you know, I mean, if someone just randomly asked me about my religious beliefs, I would totally get my guard up. But when you put it in context, I think people relax and go, okay, you know, this person isn't asking me to be judgmental. They're asking me because they want to know what's important.
Yeah, I think if you take a little bit of time, and it's difficult in anesthesia, but sometimes we do have more time to do a proper, you know, consultation or go and see patients on the ward and their families. I think if you create an environment of safety and the family or the patient themselves believes that, you know, these things are relevant, they probably will tell you or they'll start to drop little hints into the conversation and you can sort of pick those up and then go further with them. So I think it's really about developing a rapport and then allowing the conversation to unfold, I guess.
And I think you're right in finding a situation where you've got the time and somewhere where the patient feels comfortable as well. Yeah. And that may not necessarily be in the presence of their family, or it may be absolutely in the presence of their family. That in and of itself is highly variable as well, isn't it?
And look, you know, the ward environments can be challenging. You know, most of our patients where I work are in 4-bed bays. Yeah. There's no sound, you know, there's no soundproofing up there. So having difficult conversations in that environment is not preserving a lot of confidentiality.
It feels inappropriate sometimes, doesn't it? That's very true.
Yeah. So we've discussed how to best evaluate the benefits of surgery for a particular patient. So how do we then go on about mitigating non-beneficial treatments and interventions if surgery and anaesthesia is then to proceed? So really, there are two prongs to doing this, as stated in PG 67, and these are mitigating the potential for clinical momentum and managing pre-existing limitations on medical treatment.
Now, I'm sure many of us know what clinical momentum feels like. So being in a resus where treatment rapidly progresses from one step to the next is a really good example. In a way, it feels like you're on a train on a set of tracks that are going in one particular direction and you can't necessarily stop or change course. And in the end, and in a worst case scenario, the patient can end up receiving unwanted care.
Now, I'm sure we've also all been in a resus situation where from the get-go, somebody steps up and communicates to the resuscitation team that the patient is not for X, Y, or Z intervention. And from there, a rapid decision as to the most appropriate course of action ensues. These resus scenarios feel different when there's a member that can step in and say stop if events progress beyond the patient's documented desires.
Yeah, and look, for that to work, it relies on team members being aware of these care and intervention limitations and being able to effectively and clearly communicate them to the team. And look, often this responsibility falls to us, the anaesthetists. We're often tasked with running a resus, and to do this appropriately for any patient, we need to know what their desires for care are and any limitations to that care.
Mitigating the potential for clinical momentum involves discussion with the patient or substitute decision maker about the range of potential outcomes. Both with and without resuscitation, any responses that the team can have to iatrogenic complications and any potential or intended locations for postoperative care. It is important for the team and patient to all have an understanding of and agreement about acceptable patient-centered outcomes and suitable options for ongoing care following the surgery and anaesthetic, and whether there is a realistic potential that these will be met. This discussion should also include goals of care and its limitations as a way to guide the best care for the patient in the post-operative setting.
Managing pre-existing limitations on medical treatment is necessary once the decision has been made to undertake surgery and anaesthesia, and this involves discussion with the patient or decision maker and clear documentation of the outcome of the discussion. Generally speaking, previous limitations to care can be suspended, modified, or continued.
Suspension describes a withdrawal of pre-existing limitations of medical treatment and the implementation of full resuscitation strategies for the duration of the perioperative period. It's important to note that the automatic and unilateral suspension of pre-existing limitations of medical treatment is not tolerated medico-legally.
Modification occurs where specific limitations to medical treatment are modified to include the provision of specific medications, techniques, or resuscitative measures for the duration of the perioperative period, and these can either be technique-based or values-based. Technique-based modifications often include interventions necessary to provide safe anesthesia or surgery. Examples include intubation, mechanical ventilation, and invasive monitoring, but may prohibit resus measures like chest compressions or defibrillation. Values-based modifications occur where clinical judgment is used to determine what is appropriate to do in the context of a patient's values and preferred outcomes. Continuation of limitations to medical treatment occurs where any pre-existing limitations are upheld for the duration of the perioperative period.
When talking to patients about how pre-existing limitations to medical treatment are going to be managed perioperatively, it's important to cover the following points. The implications of the current pre-existing limitations, the likelihood of the patient needing resuscitation at any point within the perioperative period, and any potential interventions and their consequences. When documenting the outcome of this discussion, it is important to clearly include whether the decision is to suspend, modify, or maintain any pre-existing medical limitations, that agreement has been reached about the interventions to undertake perioperatively in the event of patient deterioration, and to list those present for this discussion. It is also important to decide when previously existing limitations to medical treatment are to be reinstated.
Now, even though we tried to cover PG67 as thoroughly as possible, we still encourage you all to take the time to read both the guidelines as well as its background paper. Links to these papers have been included in our episode notes, so please check them out. Now, before we say farewell, what have you learned in anaesthesia this week, Kate?
Well, apart from our own podcast, because you did prepare this episode, so I had had a bit of a look through after you'd written this all, and I actually think this guideline kind of crystallizes things that maybe are not 100% well understood.
Yeah.
So things like, well, if they're not for intubation, we can't do an operation. What's the point? We'll have to do a spinal. But in fact, yeah, there's nothing wrong with temporarily changing certain measures to give patients a chance or to watch them for a certain, to give their operation, support them in a slightly higher dependency environment, for example, for 24 hours and then to reassess.
Yeah.
Now, that's when the clinical momentum comes in, and I think that's another interesting discussion.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I think that's one thing I've learned.
Yeah, that's good.
I'm still on parental leave. But what I did actually learn, I did have a meeting with a colleague who has become involved in the voluntary assisted dying legislation, which we've just implemented in Queensland.
Oh, now that I find fascinating.
And it was really interesting. And I think the patients that have, as far as I understand, the patients that have chosen that pathway so far, it's been a really positive experience for them and their families.
Wow.
And I know that both morally and religiously we'll have people listening that don't agree with voluntary assisted dying. But, it was just really interesting having an insight into how it works. I didn't realise that there was a choice of oral preparation or intravenous.
Oh, wow.
So you can have it in hospital if you wish.
Wow.
Which some people may prefer. It was just a very interesting discussion, and I'll be interested to hear more about it as time goes on.
We'll have to talk more about this once we stop recording, but I find the whole thing quite fascinating. And in truth, at this point in time, I haven't sat with it for long enough and thought about it enough to know where I sit on it. So that's something I'm going to have to do a bit of reading and, talk to some people and work out how it actually works before I really, develop my own opinion on it. Because at this stage, I know very little about it, but it's something that I'm curious about.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's legal, basically it's in legislation now, right?
Queensland, that's the thing.
So, regardless of what personal opinions may exist about it,
it's
a thing. But
I suppose it's more in the sense of what I feel about it in terms of if I think it's a service that I could be a part of without it impacting my own mental health.
Yeah.
I think that's probably what I need to sit with. It's not so much the legality of it, because my approach is always, look, if it's legal and it's someone's decision, that's fair enough. But it's more of a how I would go, being in a situation where I'm helping someone, get what they want essentially and to provide them with their wishes, but how it would affect me. Because I just don't know. I just don't know.
I agree with you. Yeah, it's something I'm actually supportive of voluntary assisted dying as a concept and a healthcare service that's available.
Yeah.
But I'm like, how close could I get to the process?
I just don't know if I'm capable of doing it without it affecting me negatively.
It's a really interesting, it's just a fascinating question. But anyway, the point is, I think there are some dying patients in our community who are having deaths on their own terms.
Yeah.
And personally, I think that's fantastic.
Yeah.
And it's been quite a positive thing overall.
Yeah.
So how about you? What have you learned in anaesthesia this week?
Okay, so I suppose what I've learned this week is that I've got a bit more of an idea of how to do a supra-inguinal block.
Oh, okay.
So one of the – and this is something that you know, listeners as registrars will soon come to realize when you're a consultant is that it's very common to have registrars come through that are frankly better at things than you are. It happens all the time. It's very humbling. And something that I see a lot is there are a lot of registrars that come through that are really good with blocks.
So you mean supra-inguinal fascia-iliaca
blocks? Fascia-iliaca blocks, okay, yeah. Yeah. Sorry, the did I not say? Yeah, the old bow tie. I have had such trouble finding that bow tie in the past. And I've been lucky enough to work with some registrars that are really proficient and really slick with blocks. And I've watched a couple of them do it and I feel like I'm slowly getting an idea of, yeah, slowly. It's a slow process. It's a useful
block for where you work.
It is very useful. We do a lot of NOFs and it is very useful. And I'm still not great. I still struggle sometimes to find that really nice bow tie, but I'm definitely improving. And I mean, it just goes to show that the learning process, it happens all through our careers, and just be open to it. You can rage against it or you can embrace it with open arms. And I'm trying very hard to embrace it with open arms, even though there's a little voice in my mind telling me that I'm an old dog that can't learn new tricks.
Does that mean I have to learn how to use TikTok?
I don't understand TikTok. But yeah, so that's what I've learned in anesthesia this week, is that I'm slowly getting a better handle on supra-inguinal fascia-iliaca blocks. So, and I think they're going to be very useful.
I think so too. Pretty good.
Well, that's all we have time for on today's episode of Deep Breaths. Don't forget to claim CPD if you're a provisional fellow or consultant, and instructions for how to do so are in our episode notes. If you like what you hear, please rate us on your favourite podcast platform.
And you can always get in touch with us at deepbreathspod@gmail.com with suggestions, questions, or to say hi. Thanks for listening, and we hope you can join us next time on Deep Breaths.